to plead my case. No obvious. Send me into outer space. And my fingers, I'll be June with diamonds and gold. But that ain't gonna help me now.
All right, crank it up, John. I got lots of trouble. I am locked and loaded with trouble today. I assure you of that. I'm the Nancy Skinner Show. No, don't keep it going. There you go. You're taking away my juice, my Red Bull. All right, it is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-866-991-9927, the number to the program. I just never want the song to go away. Now, I know that a lot of people do or do not like that song. You can continue to weigh in on my website, nancyskinnerlive.com. Happy to have you participate in that debate about the theme song. Because it's sort of fun, but I don't have time for it. We'll get into that a little bit later. We've got lots going on today. 866-991-9927 until we find our new 800 number. Big day. It has been and continues to be, will be. Tonight is the second primetime news conference that President Obama will hold. Just as a note, that it took President Bush 90 days to have his first, and now this is the second primetime news conference already in less than 60 days. So President Obama has not been clearing a lot of brush, apparently. He's been at work, hard at work. We're going to talk a little bit about this. Let me give you a preview of what's coming up today. What you want to hear, you know, what you think you're going to hear. I like to do a difference here. What you think you're going to hear, but what you really want to hear. Because the White House has always said, you know, we think there's like two conversations going on. There's like the cable shows and the inside D.C. chatter. And then there's like real people out there in the world. Yeah, those people that we go on Leno and we talk to them and we go out and try and get around you. So those people aren't going to be asking the questions tonight. Here's your chance to do it. Put them out there at 866-991-9927. We're going to get into that throughout the show because that's always going to be a big deal. That starts at 8 o'clock tonight. Coming up, I want to make sure you hear this. Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, will be joining us because he leads the Democracy for America group that really, if you think about it, laid the groundwork for a lot of the change that we have become, because it was the first sort of grassroots effort and got people into groups. And tomorrow is their fifth anniversary, and they're kicking off house parties across the land, far and wide. Topic du jour tomorrow, health care. Oh, yeah, that thing that a lot of us don't have. So I'm looking forward to that. Jim's a great guy, and you can jump in on that as well. And then let's see. I have critics from the left, critics from the right. Everybody's panning Geithner's plan from yesterday. We talked about the toxic asset plan. So we'll be enjoying a rich discussion of toxic assets, how to clear them from the market. I came up with, after our conversation yesterday, I came up with the missing link in all this. Is thinking, I'm going through, I'm reading all my economic stuff. I'm geeking out extraordinarily last night. So coming up, it just hit me what the missing link was. So we're going to be going through all of that. But I think the big news story was I spent all morning watching the hearings, the AIG oversight hearings. And so I think that's what we're going to start off with here. Get your reaction if you were watching any of those the hearings. They're just riveting. They are riveting. Got lots of sound from them for you. And why are they riveting? Okay, let me tell you the five things I watched again today. We saw the first round. Now this is the House committee. We watched the subcommittee hearings last time around with Paul Kanjorki, I believe his name was, the subcommittee chairman. This was Barney Frank in his element chairing this committee, okay? And it was about AIG, the oversight, and you know, what happened, And I'm going to tell you the five things I learned out of the hearing so you don't have to sit through and watch it. But it was fun, and I captured a lot of the fun stuff for you. But this was a testimony by the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner, and William Dudley, who didn't get a lot of airplay, honestly, I must say today. He was the Federal Reserve Chair in New York now. So it was pretty fascinating viewing if you are a geek like me. And I'm going to tell you the five things I learned and the news. I knew it would be news, looking at my websites, getting up every morning, checking out the infamous sites I do, Huffington Post and The Drudge, and how it's played both ways. U.S. seeks expanded power to seize firms, screams a headline in The Washington Post today. We're going to get into that. But let me give you that headline, and then we'll put it into context, and I'll tell you the five things I learned at the hearings today. The news is that the Obama administration is considering asking Congress to give the Treasury Secretary unprecedented powers to initiate the seizure of non-bank financial companies, such as large insurers, AIG, investment firms, and hedge funds, whose collapse would damage the broader economy, according to an administration document. The government, as at present, has the authority only to seize banks. That's called the FDIC. They can reorganize banks. And so we're going to talk about this because both Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner mentioned several times the need for what's called a resolution authority. So here's a new word in our vocabulary we're going to have to learn. It's a good thing. Here's the bottom line. It means if we had the authority in the first place, if we had this resolution of authority, if they had the ability to do what they want to do now, there wouldn't have been an AIG bonus scandal because they could have done things completely differently. So I learned a lot during these hearings. I think it's important because, you know, I follow it like in geek-like fashion for me to digest that for you and tell you what I learned, the five things I learned. Do I have time to start that? Yeah, I do. The first thing I learned was whodunit. We spent a lot of time last week on whodunit. Who was responsible for the bonuses? And in fact, that has taken a toll on the president's poll ratings. Everyone's got to poll everything. CBS News did a poll saying that for the first time since he's taken office, that the AIG bonus thing has affected President Obama. That's the first time that a significant number of Americans are expressing disapproval of his actions, specifically related to the handling of the AIG bonuses. 42% disapprove of the handling of that, while roughly the same percent, 41% approve. Well, I mean, okay, the way that headline is set up, we're 1% off. The people are mixed. They don't know whether they approve of it or not because they don't know why it was done. I mean, this is such a confusing situation. No wonder people are confused. I would have, if I were writing that headline, I would have said people are confused about the handling of the AIG bonus thing. Why that happened, how that happened, more than that they disapprove. But that's, I guess you don't click on that and get click on revenues on your website if you put that kind of thing on the thing. All right, well, what we learned about whodunit was basically that it was the staff. Staff done it. Because Ben Bernanke, we went through this yesterday, right, last week with the testimony of Ed Liddy, when he said, I had been talking to Ben Bernanke, but not necessarily Tim Geithner. Tim Geithner said, yeah, we knew about it. Well, they both learned about it March 10th. These two guys, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, March 10th, and then tried to stop it. They were told they couldn't stop it because of legal issues, that these guys could go back and sue them and get twice what the contracts were for, so they didn't use any sort of authority. They said, let's just cut a better deal. The staff apparently had known a little earlier than that. We don't know. That's the whodunit. But that's not the good part. The good part is, that's the boring part now. We spent all week on something that is really wasn't that interesting. The good part is, I'm so glad to know why they had to do what they did, what it means for the future, and how they propose to fix it, which is really the cool part. And then, just the boneheaded congresspeople asking questions was just sheer entertainment. Sheer entertainment value today. 866-991-9927. Did you watch any of these hearings? And how can a hearing on something as complicated as resolution authority be entertaining? It's mind-boggling, but it truly, truly is. So we'll be going. I got some sound on that. You'll want to stick around and hear it right here on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Recall that these events took place before the passage of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, which provided the funds that the Treasury used to help stem a global banking panic in October. Consequently, it is unlikely that the failure of additional major firms could have been prevented in the wake of a failure of AIG. At best, the consequences of AIG's failure would have been a significant intensification of an already severe financial crisis and a further worsening of global economic conditions. Conceivably, its failure could have resulted in a 1930-style global financial and economic meltdown with catastrophic implications for production, income, and jobs.
I don't know about you, but I'm not for that. I am not for that 1930-style global economic meltdown to which Chairman Bernanke referred. It is the Nancy Skinner Show, 866-991-9927. Did you see these hearings today? Because I want to know what stood out to you. There are a number of things that have stood out to me. I'm going to go through those. But did any one congressperson, as colorful as this set is, stand out for you? Did any aha moments happen for you throughout this whole thing? Like, okay, here's why we like had to do what we had to do. Because I'm certainly, I put it all into perspective mode. What stood out to you? 866-991-9927. That's the number to the program. Here's what I learned. We already went through this. The five things that I learned today was whodunit. It fell through the staff at the staff level. Because these guys didn't find out specifically about the AIG bonuses to the Financial Products Division, which is the group of guys that tanked AIG to begin with, that caused the outrage until March 10th. And they tried to undo that damage, and they could not do it. I also learned why they did it. I think that they did a very good job. Both Ben Bernanke, the chairman, and Tim Geithner did a very good job of explaining very clearly why it is that they did it. And what he said was, that was Ben Bernanke that cut. Look, AIG, and this is the hard thing with the opposition out there, with the Republicans out there just saying, you got Ron Paul, he was in this hearing, Michelle Bachmann, I have some of that congresswoman who was on Hardball that said that we got to seek out anti-American views in Congress. These were the people questioning them, you know, the conspiracy Bilderberger people kind of questioning, well, why did the government do this? And a lot of people in general, because it's so complicated, don't understand, why did the government have to come in and bail out AIG? And basically they said, look, hey, this company, 130 countries that they operate in, that it was, they were talking about counterparties in this thing. Well, what's a counterparty? A counterparty is everybody that was owed money. So let's say you have a pension, you have a 401k, or you have an insurance policy. All this money was invested at AIG, right? And banks had money that they were owed from AIG. So if AIG, it was going down, if they went down and nothing was done, because we saw what happened with Lehman. Lehman went down, the market freaked out. And your 401ks started losing value because everyone started, the market said, well, we got all these bad assets on the books, and they couldn't value them, so it started taking the whole market down. Now, so what happened is they said, well, we have to step in and make sure that AIG is solvent. The Fed only has the authority to write a check, okay? The Fed, not like FDIC. If there's a bank that's going bad, we learned this after the Depression. Read up on your FDR. I certainly have been. But what happened was, they created the FDIC, so you know that you're insured now up to $250,000. It used to be $100,000. They've upped that limit, right? So that authority doesn't exist for companies like AIG. That's what they were proposing today. And if they hadn't done something, then you would have had – there's a great interchange I'm going to play for you between this Illinois congressman and Bernanke, which these guys – it's more about grandstanding than anything. They would ask a question – and then they wouldn't let him answer. They would cut him off. They would, here's what I want you to say. Is this or is this not true? And they're trying to explain complex theory, economic theory, why they did what they did, and they weren't allowed to answer. I digress. That's number five on my list. However, what I did learn is that they had no choice. AIG was going to take down the whole system. The 1930s global meltdown, because of the way that we have had a lack of regulation over these years, they had no choice. They had to step in. Yes, they did. I think that was very clear from all parties that they had no choice but to step in. That whole systemic meltdown thing, the 1930s, food lines, mass confusion, political unrest, not for it, not so much. What struck you about these hearings today? Did you watch them? Was there any enlightenment, or you just throw your hands up in the air with total confusion? I have no idea. 866-991-9927, the number to the program. I've got more cuts, more sound, and fury signifying nothing, as Shakespeare would say, for you right here on the Nancy Skinner Show.
I would note that AIG offers two clear lessons for the upcoming discussion in the Congress and elsewhere on regulatory reform. First, AIG highlights the urgent need for new resolution procedures for systemically important non-bank financial firms. If a federal agency had had such tools on September 16th, they could have been used to put AIG into conservatorship or receivership, unwind it slowly, protect policyholders, and impose haircuts on creditors and counterparties as appropriate. That outcome would have been far preferable to the situation we find ourselves in now. Second, the AIG situation highlights the need for strong, effective, consolidated supervision of all systemically important firms. AIG built up its concentrated exposure to the subprime mortgage market largely out of the sight of its functional regulators. More effective supervision might have identified and blocked the extraordinarily reckless risk-taking at AIG FP. These two changes could measurably reduce the likelihood of future episodes of systemic risk like the one we faced at AIG. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There we go. Two clear lessons learned today during the hearings on the meltdown. Your daily update on the Nancy Skinner Show. 866-991-9927. Glued to the television this morning. This, I don't even know how long it went on. Did anyone watch the hearings at all? Did you come away with any better understanding than, say, your typical member of Congress? Because, frankly, they scared me with some of the questions. Some of them understood the scope of the crisis, but for the most part, not so much. Not so much. Which you don't really expect members of the Financial Services Committee to not have a firm grasp of why we did this, but as we go through this, you will see. So what's new today? What's the new story? And something you need to know, that the administration is sending legislation over to Congress asking for this new resolution authority to deal with non-bank institutions. Now, that sounds like some scary thing. What they're saying is, look, it's the same thing we do with banks right now. That's what we learned from the last depression. We got to insure the deposits. That's what he said. Okay, and that's what Bernanke said. So what we need now is, we got to be able to do the same thing with non-bank institutions like insurance companies, because AIG is an insurance company with a hedge fund on top. It's not a bank, but we're on the hook for them. They could have taken the whole global economy down. So before we just write blank checks to prevent that from happening, from them blowing themselves up, as the president used the analogy the other day, we have to have, that's enough carrots, we need sticks. We need sticks to go with the carrots. That's the clear lesson. And they started talking about rehauling the whole legislative or the whole regulatory framework so it doesn't happen again. Is that too hard to understand? So we learned that. That's what they want, the resolution authority. There'll be a big debate. I guarantee you, you'll be 2 days above the cable news chatter on this by the time people figure out what that is. And they're going to say, this is about nationalizing the banks. It's not about nationalizing the banks. It is about having the means to restructure. Those bonuses would not have happened if they could have gone in, if they had the authority, and we're going to play Michelle Bachmann because I'm trying to think of which one of these guys was my favorite today. I think it's Michelle Bachmann. If they had the authority to go in and say when AIG needed their first round of $80 billion because there was going to be a global meltdown, then they could have said, okay, but here's the deal. We're taking you into receivership. and you're not paying these bonuses, and you're going to unwind this because this was way too risky and you're overextended, and we're going to do this. We're going to get rid of the bad management, and we're going to, you know, get this firm healthy again and put it back out in its way. But without that authority, we can just write unlimited checks, and they can go out and do whatever the heck they want. So while everyone's going to get freaked out about what that means, that's exactly how we're going to prevent these further meltdowns from happening. Okay, so let's move to the fun part then. So you've learned what essentially these, and I was really relieved to hear Bernanke and Geithner on the same page. I think both of them are highly intelligent, having followed this and commented on the global meltdown and the need for this. I feel a renewed sense of confidence that they did the right thing. They did the best thing that they could. Not the AIG bonuses. I'll beg to differ on that, only because I would have not given the money out and then said, because there's a contractual obligation for that, what I would have said is take us to court. You might have a contractual obligation, so sue me. So my gut instinct remains the same on that. Okay, Michelle Bachmann was the congresswoman from Minnesota, who was caught up in the news when she was on Hardball because she said that we had to seek out anti-American views in Congress and root them out. Michelle Bachmann, here's my story on that. Yeah, and it didn't go over so well in her district. In fact, she had a primary challenge and almost lost in a very conservative district. So she's a member of the House Financial Services Committee, and she's asking questions of the Fed chair and the Secretary of the Treasury. Here's a little of Michelle Bachmann.
The American people are looking at the actions of both the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Secretary, and they are wondering if their government is making an historic shift, jettisoning the free market capitalism in favor of centralized government economic planning. I wonder, Mr. Secretary, if you would comment on that.
I do not believe that concern is justified. I understand why people will be worried about this, but what we're doing is using authority that Congress gave us, authority that was designed to help protect the American economy from these kind of failures.
Reclaiming my time, Mr. Secretary, what provision in the Constitution could you point to give authority for the actions that have been taken by the Treasury since March of 08?
Oh, well, the Congress legislated in the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act a range of very important new authorities.
Sir, in the Constitution, what in the Constitution could you point to give authority to the Treasury
Congress
for the extraordinary
say
actions
legislating?
Every action that the Treasury and the Fed and the FDIC is been using authority granted by this body. By this body of the Congress.
And by in the Constitution, what could you point to?
Under the laws of the land, of course.
And if I could move to the Federal Reserve Chair, if you could point to what provision in the Constitution would give authority to the Federal Reserve. This has been over $10 trillion that we're talking about.
I don't know where $10 trillion comes from. The Congress has the right to authorize funds.
This is an elected member of Congress, people.
And they have given us, in the 1930s, they gave the Federal Reserve the power for emergency lending as a means of addressing financial crises, which is what we've done.
And to the Federal Reserve Chair, do you believe there are any limits on the authority that the Federal Reserve has taken since last March of 08?
The loans we make have to be fully secured and collateralized. We have practical limits in terms of our ability to manage monetary policy, so there are obviously limits. We have reported extensively to the Congress on all the actions that we've taken, and the actions we've taken have been solely and entirely for the purpose of protecting the American economy from the effects of financial collapse.
Per the Constitution, I reclaim my time, per the Constitution. And Geithner says, well, Congress passed. This is like 101. I can't believe he's explaining. These guys are having to explain 101 to members of Congress. Per Congress passed legislation. Oh, to the Constitution? What specifically, sir, in the Constitution? Well, when Congress passes a bill, see, because Congress is like authorized by the Constitution to pass bills. So you know, these guys are wasting valuable time, honestly. You know, I suppose there's value in that I was glad to hear from them firsthand the underpinnings of what was going on. But there was a certain sense of what a waste of their valuable time. Specifically, what in the Constitution has allowed you to do this? The legislation. All right, now here's what's really funny. Okay, so that's great irony, Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, trying to figure out, you know, saying we're taking this economy and making it a communist, centrally planned economy. Where's the constitutional outrage? What? Why are you following the law? And they had tried to explain in both their opening setups, look, we don't have the authority to do anything but write checks right now, the way it is. That's why we need this thing called resolution authority, because we can't do anything. We could just give them, write them a blank check so that they don't collapse and we go down with it. So this is her follow-through question.
Could you tell me why AIG was not put into receivership as opposed to conservatorship, Mr. Secretary?
Again, no legal means existed under U.S. law to resolve AIG using the kind of powers available to the FDIC to resolve a bank. Because of the absence of that authority, your government was faced with no good options, and we chose the best option available at the time to help protect the economy from systemic damage. If we had different authority, we would have different choices.
So do you get that? She is grilling them about not having the authority to act in the first place, or, you know, what is your constitutional authority? And then her second question is in absolute conflict with her first question. Well, why didn't you put them in receivership versus conservatorship, which is the same difference? The point is we take over the firm and we sort it out. I mean, we have effective control while we're giving them money. So she has no problem. She's making them find the constitutional authority to do this. And then when they said, we didn't have that authority, ma'am, Congresswoman, then she asked them why they didn't do it. And these are members of Congress. This is, to me, this was pure entertainment. Forget like House or great shows that I, Desperate Housewives. I had more fun watching Michelle Bachmann try and ask questions of people well, you know, way, way overqualified to answer. So what did you find interesting? Did that, like, resonate? Did anyone catch that? I have more sound. I'll play for you. 866-991-9927. Ron Paul has some really deep questions as well when we come back. We'll have a little Ron Paul. And to be fair, I'm going to be fair. I have to say this, Maxine Waters, I have to challenge Mrs. Congressman Waters, because she, I think she had a set agenda with Secretary Geithner today. She didn't represent us too well. Let's put it that way. The Democratic Party, I should say. Them too well. 866-991-9927. Learn anything about either the meltdown or the members of Congress that are clueless therein? Oh, because I got a quote from FDR about that. Oh, yeah, we've been through this exact same thing, the whole thing with Congress and the president. Yeah, we have. Wait till you hear this quote. Coming up next after the break on the Nancy Skinner Show. From watching the hearings, the House Financial Services hearings on the global economic meltdown. What's your global economic meltdown lesson for the day? On the Nancy Skinner Show, 866-991-9927. Besides that, there's a lot of buffoons in Congress, which is striking me as something I, not that I didn't know that, but it seemed, it was a little more than obvious and over the top today during these hearings. These people don't really know about the economy, and they're running the country. Let's go out to Los Angeles and talk to Lynn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how you doing? I'm so delighted to get on your show. I love that you often cross conservative, liberal, the whole thing, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
I have to take a little issue with you today, though, because I believe that we need simple economics. I think we need kitchen table economics. I think this global meltdown is simply the result of every time a large corporation put out a mom and pop, and every time a multinational corporation sent jobs overseas, we're not producing enough in this country to support ourselves. And so if I'm around the table and I'm spending more than I make, guess what? I have to declare bankruptcy, or I have to do something. I have to stop spending. And this economy, I think if we actually let the economy go completely, the only thing that happened is mom and pops would spring up again. And the only people I think that would really get hurt are the international bankers who suck the money out as stuff is changing countries. And I think simple economic, and I wish you would play Ron Paul, because I haven't had a chance yet to listen to the hearing overnight.
Right, yeah, I'll play it for you. Let me respond real quickly to that, and then I hear you, and I think what the president's going to talk about in his press conference, we'll talk about that, is that we have to do these simple things. We do have to deal with trade. We do have to. But here's something that it's tougher. Because when those international bankers go down, they could take away the pensions and the 401ks. And I think Bernanke, let's play it, because this question came up. Here's Ron Paul asking Bernanke about what the
economy. If you come from the viewpoint that says that the market doesn't work, I can understand everything you do. But if I see that you've totally rejected the market, that you didn't, and that we have to do something about it, I can understand why we in the Congress and you in Treasury and you in the Fed continue to do this. So where do you put the blame? On the market or on crony capitalism that we've been living with probably for three decades?
Congressman, I certainly do not reject capitalism. I don't think this was a failure of capitalism per se. And I also think that free markets should be the primary mechanism for allocating capital. They've shown over many decades that they can allocate money to new enterprises, to new technologies very effectively. And so we want to maintain that free capital market structure. It is nevertheless the case that we've seen over the decades and the centuries that financial systems can be prone to panics, runs, booms, busts. And for better or worse, we have developed mechanisms like deposit insurance and lender of last resort to try to avert those things. Protections in turn require some oversight to avoid the buildup of risk.
May I interrupt, please?
Certainly.
Isn't that what creates the moral hazard, though? Isn't that the problem rather than the solution?
All right, here's where you have to. He
if
said.
You come from the viewpoint
I don't want to play it again. All right, he said, do you support markets or crony capitalism? The reason that's wrong, Lynn, the problem with that is that unregulated markets are crony capitalism. They are the same thing. Using the word market just doesn't make it magically perfect. And what Bernanke was saying is we've learned that there are booms and busts and the market needs to be regulated. So I think Ron Paul is more, he's playing on a populist theme like the crony capitalists and the Bilderbergers and all that, but that's what unregulated markets are. Greed. It's just greed run amok.
Am I still on?
Yes, you are, Lynn.
Oh, okay, good. My concern is that in this entire silliness, it is the bankers that still get their bonuses. And I think that that's indicative of what protectionism is. Somebody's going to get protected by the Congress, by whatever rules. And in this case, because of people didn't ask enough questions or whatever, the crony capitalists, I mean, the international bankers are still getting theirs. I mean, not everybody at AIG is even a U.S. citizen or lives
correct.
In the country, for what
I understand. So what they're saying is, and I don't disagree with you, Lynn, and that's what Bernanke said.
If I could say one more thing, and then I'll hang up because that's going to work. You say that it will take down the 401Ks. I thought everyone's 401K already went down.
It went down 40%. That question was posed. They were like, this one senator from, or congressman from Illinois went on and on. He said, if we didn't do what we did, you might have lost 40% from your 401k. If we didn't do this, you would have lost 70%. So here's the thing, Lynn, and I know you got to run, so I'm going to let you go. I appreciate you calling, but here's the thing about the difference. What these guys are not saying is let's just pay these people their money, the bankers their money, and be on with it and go back to the market. They're saying, no, we had to do this. So you don't lose 70%, but here's what we want. We need this resolution authority so this never happens again, so that these international bankers can't do this. Yes, they held us hostage. Yes, they could have pushed a button and exploded themselves. They could have been suicide bombers, and we could have had the 1930s meltdown. Yep, we had to do it. But these guys just walked into this mess. And but they at least were saying, here is what we need to do. And they gave us something so that it never happens again. And we did this in the Depression. This is just bigger and uglier now. But there's at least a solution. So I was very happy to hear that. Coming up, we're going to hear the solutions that DFA, Democracy for America, has. Jim Dean, Howard's brother. I bet he hates being called that. We'll have to ask him that. It's 5th anniversary tomorrow, and they're going to change the world from the ground up. So you can join Jim Dean and myself right here on The Nancy Skinner Show. People are writing me they're scared about Michelle Bachmann. Members of the committee in Congress that are scaring the heck out of them, watching the hearings. Well, there's something you can do. It's called Get Involved in Democracy. It's the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. Thanks for being with me. 866-991-9927. The number of the program, more slowly, 866-991-9927. All right, so in the last hour, we were playing some of the cuts from the hearings, the financial services hearings. Michelle Bachmann, Ron Paul, and others who clearly don't understand what's going on with the economy. And so it's important to understand that we elect them, that we put those people there. And democracy starts with us. And so what perfect timing, actually, to bring on Jim Dean, who's the executive director of Democracy for America, the nation's largest progressive political action community, something like 725,000 members across this nation. And I would say probably the group that started the whole progressive movement for change to begin with. Howard Dean founded it on his presidential campaign, little house parties. All of a sudden people started to realize they had to wake up and get involved in democracy, went to house parties, and they went from 350,000 members to 1 million, 350 original groups to 800 in almost every congressional district. They have training programs. 13,000 graduates figure out how to get out there and be active participants in their democracy. And they've supported over 1,000 congressional candidates, including me. So what better timing on the eve of their 5th anniversary to talk to Jim Dean about what's up their sleeve for finishing the job. Hi, Jim Dean.
Hey, Nancy. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Back on the radio.
Right on, man. I'm glad to hear it as well.
Even though I was one of those 1,000 candidates having the proud honor of winning your 2008 All-Star Best Congressional Candidate in America contest in 2008. Too bad, Jim, that I'm not sitting on the House Financial Services Committee asking the right questions. What do you think of, like, Michelle Bachmann? Have you seen some of these people in action?
I haven't. I've actually been all over the place today, so I haven't been in front of a TV set. One quick minor correction. We've supported 1,000 candidates. But I wasn't sure if there have actually been 1,000 congressional candidates since we've been in existence, so I thought we'd better just say that includes federal and non-federal.
All candidates. All right.
And,
sorry.
But I haven't been watching this. And you know, I mean, I've seen, of course, Alan Grayson's work, and we're very proud to have supported him when he, you know, really tried to call out some of these Federal Reserve people on the carpet about what they're doing with the taxpayers' money. But I just, you know, I don't think a lot of these folks really get this, and Howard made a point on a TV show yesterday that, you know, it's not as much about the money that people are making as much as it is about the fact that these people are being rewarded for doing a horrible job, for failing. And to the extent that, you know, these financial services people in the committee are willing to let this keep going, you know, we've got to totally change that. And the only way you can do that is beginning by getting more Alan Graysons and Donna Edwardses and Nancy Skinners into Congress.
Well, you know, thank you for saying that. Even as the Democrat, the Blue Dogs, are causing, you know, now the president's going to come out. He's got his press conference tonight, and he's going to talk a lot about his budget. Members of his own, now there's a Senate Blue Dog group. We've always had them in the House. You have even Democrats who are opposing the president and not understanding a lot of the fundamentals. So what you guys do at your DFA meetings is so crucial. Just getting people, whoever thought, first of all, go back for me, Jim. I know your brother started DFA, but who's Joe Trippi was involved? What was the inspiration? What was that moment when you said, you know what, we got to, have house parties?
Well, I'm not sure that I remember when that was, but I know what the thinking was that was going into all of this when Howard's campaign ended. It was that there was this incredible network of incredible people who had done incredible things. And the idea that that was just going to stop wasn't really acceptable, I think, to Howard or anybody else. So he really sort of morphed that into a political action community, and the whole idea was is that these groups and the members would still keep going and try to help people running for office locally. I think one of the first things Howard did after DFA got founded was go and stump for someone who was running for library trustee, and people were saying, well, you know, how come a presidential candidate is doing that? And you know, this is the stuff that really is important. It's important to help people take responsibility over the political process. And everything that we've really done since then, the training and all of that, is really to try to make it easier for people to give what valuable time they've got to making this democracy better. You know, it's not easy to do what you do all day and then spend 2 hours at a planning and zoning meeting. But it's the stuff that makes the world go round. We've got to leverage a national network and help make it easier for people to run for office and really take responsibility and take back control of the political process. Because as Howard used to say, politics is too important to be left up to the professionals.
Say that again. Trust me, I've had my interchanges with professionals.
So, yeah, as we're seeing right now, by the way.
So what happens when you go through a training for people who've not been there? They might be intimidated by that word, a training.
It's really actually pretty easy. We did one in Lansing actually this summer, this last summer. We finally got to Michigan for a training, which was great, and we're looking forward to coming back at some point. It's a 2-day session, includes 2 lunches and the social hour, and a lot of, there's a part on how to identify and target voters, there's a part on how to, talk to the media, how to recruit volunteers, how to raise money, and it's interactive. You know, we've got 4 or 5 trainers that are there on site, but it's, you know, again, a very much of an interactive thing. We don't have just one person talking at you for 2 days. We go through a lot of different exercises and role playing. It's somewhat intense, but it's really there just to give people the knowledge and what it takes to run for office. And more importantly, for those who don't want to run for office, it gives people the knowledge of what happens when you're working on a campaign and what are the elements that are really important, so that when you go and say volunteer in a campaign the next time, you're going to be in a position really actually to take on a lot of responsibility. Hopefully get hired on staff, but really make a significant contribution.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't really want to stick their necks out as candidates, but you learn all aspects of a campaign
right.
Here.
So, and let's face it, it's not easy, to go to a phone bank after working at the office or wherever you work and call a bunch of people who might not be happy to hear from you at 8 o'clock at night. The purpose of our training is to make that easier and make you more effective at it.
Yeah. Do you think, Jim, that people are, because of just the reality that people are more engaged, they want to be more engaged, this economic meltdown? Like, all of a sudden, you can't just go about your happy little life watching sitcoms and going to your job. All of a sudden, you realize this is all very real, that the situation with your 401k, half of it's gone. That, all right, now I got to kind of wake up a little bit and get involved here.
I do think that. In one sense, it's easier to sit around and do what I did after my first foray into politics in college. You know, for the next 5 years, I sat around and threw beer cans at my TV set when I didn't like the news. But, you know, frankly, it's a lot more fun when you're doing something about it. But it's not easy to do that, especially, you know, once you get older and have other responsibilities. So, but it's really, really important. I mean, you got a bunch of folks in there. And it doesn't matter whether it's Lansing, whether it's Washington or my home state capital of Hartford, Connecticut, you know, there's a little bit of disconnect between the centers of power and what's going on in people's everyday lives. That's not going to change unless we get in there.
Well, Jim Dean, we're up on a break, but we're all over the country. This show is now. I know I'm from Michigan, and I talk a lot about the auto industry, yes, but we are all over the country. So you're going to have your fifth anniversary. We're going to, when we come back, I want people to know how they can get involved. Here's your chance, people. Tomorrow's the fifth anniversary, democracyforamerica.com. Jim Dean's going to tell us what they're going to tackle first. Their first challenge is going to be healthcare, I believe. So Jim Dean, the executive director of DFA, will come back and we'll figure out how you can actually get involved in this process. Instead of just going insane watching Michelle Bachmann say stupid things at the House Financial Services Committee, you can actually make a difference. 866-991-9927, the number to the program if you want to chime in on the Nancy Skinner Show. So many crises to deal with, so little time to deal with it. Thank God we have Jim Dean out there and Democracy for America so we can all band together and get through it together. It's Nancy Skinner. I'm Nancy Skinner, and this is the Nancy Skinner program, 866-991-9927, the number of the show. Jim, so you guys have your fifth anniversary. You've built up a heck of an organization nationwide and have been doing great work. And tomorrow you're going to have a big conference call at 9 p.m. Like, you tell people they can go to a house party and... Brother Howard are going to both be on this conference call?
Yeah. What we're going to do is we're doing a bunch of house parties around the country. And if you go to our site, democracyforamerica.com, you can find a party near you or different ways to get on the call. And basically, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about, it's a time for a lot of folks to get together, first of all, who, you know, have been working pretty hard at this stuff for a long time. And others who haven't been working hard in a long time but are just getting involved. So that's, I mean, that's the real fun part. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that we've done, but we also want to talk a little bit more about what we're going to be doing because we're still out there getting organized and trying to get people into politics. So, you know, one of the big pushes beyond the training and the helping people run for office stuff is getting involved with issues. And as you probably know, Howard is very committed to making sure we got a decent health care bill getting passed. And so we're going to roll out kind of a pretty big campaign on that, and we'll probably announce it during the call tomorrow.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about that. Now, he was his name was bandied about, and certainly a lot of people thought he would have been great at HHS.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not going to happen, and he's going to do something else along the lines of trying to shape and mold his version of it. And
Well, I mean, he's actually doing about five different things. He's a little bit involved with us. He's a little bit involved with a school program in New York City. You know, he's got a TV thing going, and I don't know, he's got a whole bunch of stuff going on. But
wait, what's the TV thing? I heard something about that. Is he a contributor to CNBC, right?
Yeah, CNBC. They could use a little loosening up over there. you know, it's a little provincial there on Wall Street, so I think he's giving a little additional perspective on that.
That's awesome.
So hopefully help them along a little.
Kramer, man, hanging out with Kramer's got to be intense.
Yeah, well, it's the morning show, so I don't think he actually intersects with Kramer. It's you know, those people on that show. At least he was on Monday. He was on Squawk Box.
Okay. Well, they need that balance because honestly, they, you know what's, Wall Street is way overrepresented. Main Street is not represented, and that's one of the problems. I'm a commentator on Fox Business Network, and it's usually me versus four or five other people.
Yep.
And it's all about the masters of the universe in Wall Street. And you know, I'm always talking about what about look at the auto workers. They can break the contracts, the pensions for auto workers, and make everyone take a haircut. But no, the bondholders, you know, all the Wall Street people.
You know, Nancy, you are so right about this. You know, the fact of the matter is, the biggest danger to free enterprise and capitalism isn't higher salaries on the part of people who work for a living or even government regulation. It's the fact that there's no culture of accountability among our business leadership. And unfortunately, some of these people on TV seem to think that they can still keep shilling for this, and they need folks like you on there, or my brother, making sure that they don't get away with that. I mean, what Rick Wagner did during his tenure at General Motors, frankly, you know, I know they've had these problems recently with these bailouts, but, you know, he made a lot of bad decisions, and when things went wrong at GM, about 3 or 4 years ago, the first thing he did is blame the employees and how much money they were making. That is lousy business leadership, and we've got to get that changed in a hurry.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. So how healthcare? Do you guys have a certain angle on this, or single payer, or you don't? You're not there yet. You're going to have people participate.
Well, yeah, we're sort of. First of all, this isn't really what we're. Let me just, sorry, back up for a second. Mm-hmm. We generally speaking support the Obama plan, but really, what we're really saying is the line in the sand. The line in the sand is that whatever health plan there is out, consumers, voters, taxpayers need to have a choice to get into a publicly funded program, whether they can't afford it because they can't afford health insurance, or they can't get health insurance, or they're simply fed up with the health plans, which plenty of people are because they're doing a lousy job.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be that publicly funded component. I'm not necessarily against a plan that allows private health insurance to keep going, at least for now. But I am for, you know, as long as the consumers have a choice. And that's what the Obama plan represents to me. And that's what we want to make sure that's in there.
But you're not all out on your own. And you know what's so important that you're mobilizing around this issue first, Jim? I think because all of a sudden all this talk about, well, you can't walk and chew gum. We can't do health care. We've got an economic crisis. We can't do energy. We have an economic crisis is because we haven't dealt with these entrenched, very systemic problems like health care and energy. So.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, the health care industry is, you know, frankly, sucking every last drop of red blood out of our economy right now, and has been for years. I mean, it is the largest single causer of bankruptcies in this country, and, you know, it's part and parcel of the economy. These issues are all related, and we got to tackle it, and we especially got to get a bill passed in 2009 that includes a publicly funded option so that consumers can really have a choice.
Right, because, and even from the economic standpoint, look at what it's done to our competitive disadvantage.
Yep.
Here in Detroit.
There's exactly.
So whatever reason you throw at me, it's not good enough. We got to do it.
Yep.
And you guys are doing it. Actually, this is where the rubber hits the road, folks. You can complain, and you can listen to me and get all upset going over this stuff all you want, or you can go to democracyforamerica.com, go to a house party tomorrow night, meet your neighbors, meet the people around you, get involved in the process, and make a difference. And that's what you need to do. All of us have to step up to the plate, Jim Dean. Thank you for being the leader on this one.
I'm not sure it's me, but our members are awesome, and so are a lot of folks that are doing it. And thanks for having me on.
You bet. And good luck tomorrow night. I'll definitely be at one.
Hey, real good, Nancy.
Okay. All right.
Thanks.
You bet. Jim Dean, democracyforamerica.com. Their fifth anniversary tomorrow night. How cool is that? All right. When we come back, we're going to deal with a little more update, some reactions to the hearings are coming through. Well, your calls, 866-991-9927. That's the number to the Nancy Skinner Program.
Somebody's heartbreak, but now I have to let you go. I have to let you go. You left a stain on every one of my good days, but I am stronger than you know. I have to let you go. No one's ever turned you over. No one's tried to ever let you down. Beautiful girl, bless your heart. I got a disease deep inside me, makes me feel uneasy, baby. I can't live without you. Tell me, what am I supposed to do about it? Keep your distance from me. Don't pay no attention to me.
All right, big primetime news conference tonight. It's Sounds like we're all going to have more fun, huh, watching the second primetime news conference by President Obama. Nancy Skinner here on The Nancy Skinner Show. 1-866-991-9927. What do you want to hear tonight, given that all of our heads are spinning with the economy and the economic meltdown, and a little bit of the partisan bickering about, well, you can't walk and chew gum, we can't do health care, we can't do energy, when we desperately do need to do that. So I'm going to put that question out there right now, 866-991-9927. What questions do you want those reporters to ask that they are, they'll ask some of the questions, but they'll miss a lot of questions. I saw, what was it, on NBC, what's his name, the political director, is doing a little segment trying to figure out how to get Chuck Todd, is trying to figure out how to get questions from people to the thing. So anyways, what do you want to hear? 866-991-9927. I think I know what we'll hear. I think we know that the president is going to be talking about all the different steps that they have taken so far, because we've been talking about it on the show, to get us out of this recession, move to recovery, right, and how we eventually are going to come out of this mess, because there is a plan, and we've had a pretty good rally on Wall Street the last 10 days, some good housing numbers, some good news is starting to emerge, but there are essentially, it's going to be a choice of, you know, we had bad and worse. Those were our choices, bad and worse, frankly, folks. And you know what? You know what I want to hear President Obama say? I would love to have him actually say, what's your big idea? I would. What is your big idea? We are dealing with very complicated issues here with the economy. The situation that Geithner, if you watch the hearings today, Geithner and Bernanke, the complex global situation they are dealing with and the effect on all of us is tremendous. And you have all these people on the outside with nothing constructive to say. In fact, President Obama actually mentioned that, something he rarely does. He was in an interview with the Louisville Courier Journal, and he said, as it regards sort of the lack of bipartisan cooperation, I do think that the Republican Party right now hasn't sort of figured out what it's for. And so as a proxy, they've just decided we're going to be against whatever the other side is for. That's what's not needed in an economic crisis. He added that you could play that game maybe in the early 90s when basically we were pretty prosperous. Right now, everybody's got to pull together. So essentially, you know, what's your big idea? All they are saying is what we're against. And that's what I saw in the hearing today with the likes of Michelle Bachmann and Ron Paul and this congressman from Illinois. Do I have time to play this? I'm going to play a little bit of this. I didn't get the name, folks, because I was busy cutting all this up. But this was kind of the idiocy. This was the, here's what we're against, grandstanding that isn't solving any problems. It's not going to make your 401k magically be restored or do anything. This was, I'll get his name, but he was referred to as the congressman from Illinois.
In addition to that, they've had to spend $40 billion in order to honor the insurance plan of AIG so that the people who bought insurance with them wouldn't lose any of their retirement plans. Isn't that correct?
These are loans which we expect to get paid back.
Congressman, could I try?
I think that's an improper answer. The American people have lost 40 to 50% of their retirement plans.
The purpose of the action we took with AIG, as I discussed in some detail in my testimony, was not to help any specific counterparty.
But you did. That's what happened.
It's unavoidable. You're trying to address the entire
financial system. No, I understand that you did not address the entire issue because most Americans have still lost 40 to 50% of their retirement
plans.
We're working
hard to get
Chairman, the rules are that we get to talk whenever we want. That's the rules.
Sorry.
Down in Illinois.
And they are paying $40 billion so that other people don't lose any of their retirement plan. That's what your testimony says. And that's what happened, isn't it?
Congressman, those losses to the American people.
Give me a yes or a no, please.
Far greater.
No, did the people who took out. I'm asking the questions. Did the people who took out insurance with AIG to ensure their retirement plans get reimbursed 100%, so they suffered very little loss? Yes or no?
It depends on the nature of those specific contracts. It depends on the nature of those contracts. But what the critical thing is, the damage to the average American pension
fund... No, you did not answer the question. The average American person has already lost 40 to 50% of their insurance plans.
General, with all... I would ask the people in...
All right, that's enough. It went on, and the congressman just kept saying he would not, yes or no, of a very complex situation. What he's saying is, did the people who had AIG insurance get bailed out, essentially? Yeah. You know why? Because we've already lost 40% of all of our equity. And at the end of this, finally, Bernanke was so mad, he said, they would have lost 70%. So what do you want to hear the president say as he addresses this economic meltdown, this global situation? The jobs. I mean, the Main Street stuff. The auto workers. I didn't hear any discussion of that. We're going to talk a little bit about that, how that has to be part of the plan. But, or, you know, you've got... You got the obstructionist Republicans right now who are just the party of no, like this guy, and everyone else saying, oh, the AIG bonuses, it was a disaster, they let it happen. You have that certain element, and then you have just sort of the really insane fringe. Tammy Bruce, okay, is a talk radio host, I believe. She was a candidate for Congress at one point. And she lost, and then she ended up being a talk radio host. That sounds familiar. But Tammy Bruce and I have nothing else in common, I assure you, other than having run for Congress and being a talk radio host. She was filling in for Laura Ingraham, guest hosting, and apparently her solution was to just lay it on thick on the First Lady Michelle Obama. She was discussing her visit to a D.C. classroom last week, and She basically called them trash. Well, let's listen to it. This is what she said. We got some sound. This is the height of intelligence coming from the right. Tammy Bruce filling in for Laura Ingraham.
But here's Michelle Obama explaining to some kids what it was like for her growing up because she sounded like a white person.
I did do my best. Getting good grades was always important to me. And it wasn't because my parents pounded me or that they had the expectation.
No.
It was something that I wanted for myself. I wanted an A. And I didn't care whether it was cool. Because I remember there were kids around my neighborhood who would say, oh, you talk funny. You talk like a white girl. I heard that growing up my whole life. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. But you know what? I'm still getting my A.
What? What? What is that? And then she devolves into that weird fake accent, like Hillary did when talking to black people. What? What is that? That's that. You know what that is?
Is this going to be forever?
Yeah, remember Nitrous Oxide Kid on YouTube? No, it's not going to be forever, Nitrous Oxide Kid. It's not. Can you believe that?
So do I need to introduce myself?
Yeah.
Okay.
What a shame. That must have just ruined her damn day. I wanted the A for myself, and I wanted to do it. And ooh, they said you sounded like a white person. I don't know what that means, but ooh. Huh? Man, oh man. That's who he's married to. What does that tell you? This is what we've got. You know what we've got? We've got trash in the White House. Trash is a thing that is colorblind. It can cross all eco-socionomic kind of categories. You can work on Wall Street or work at the Walmart. Trash are people who use other people to get things, who patronize others, who consider you bitter and clingy.
Okay, how about that for constructive criticism from the loyal opposition? Tammy Bruce, Joan just handed me a little bit more about that. Apparently we share nothing in common other than she once was a Democrat. She is an openly gay, pro-choice, gun-owning, pro-death penalty, voted for President Bush, authentic feminist. And she's now a conservative commentator filling in for Laura Ingraham. Honestly, that's what they're left with, the other side, at this point. We're going through a global economic meltdown, And it's going to, well, Laura Ingraham, we talked about this last week, called Meghan McCain fat. And now her substitute host is calling Michelle Obama trash. Wait, or no, she didn't say trash. She said it doesn't matter what economic, socioeconomic stratosphere you're from. What we've got trash in the White House. Now, you know, how are you expecting to rebuild your side of the aisle, your movement, when we're organizing Democracy for America parties to figure out how to solve people's problems like health care, on the one hand, and you know, help rebuild this economy that's been just shattered to pieces, and you've got people out there calling names like fat and calling the first lady trash, which is just disgusting and ignorant. And no big ideas! Where is your big idea? Where is your substance for this, people? You're going to sit there and just criticize the president and the Democrats who are trying to pick up the pieces and call them trash? Are you kidding, Tammy Bruce? That's your answer. Rush Limbaugh out there sweating at CPAC and Tammy Bruce calling the first lady trash. You guys need some serious branding, consulting, and quick. 866-991-9927, the number to the Nancy Skinner Program. Where's the intellectual firepower over on the other side in search of intelligent life? Come on, people. Global economic meltdown. I know there's always partisanship, but this is crazy. Tammy Bruce filling in for Laura Ingraham, resorting to calling the First Lady white trash. Or not white trash, just trash, she said. She said it doesn't matter. That's what he's married to. You know what we've got? We've got trash in the White House. Trash is a thing that is colorblind. It can cross all socioeconomic categories. You can work on Wall Street or you can work at the Walmart. Trash are people who use other people to get things, who patronize others, who consider you bitter and clingy. That's the full quote in context. Doesn't really help change anything for me. It's just ignorant. Ignorant and bitter and vapid of really anything that the other side needs right now. I mean, where are their leaders? That we have a press conference. We're trying to pick up the pieces. What do you want to hear? What do you want to hear President Obama say tonight? 866-991-9927. The number to the program. Let's go out to Missouri and talk to Mo. Hi, Mo.
Hey, yes, it's Mo in Los Angeles, not Mo in Mo.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
All right, darling. You know, the first thing I think I noticed when I heard that woman speaking was she referred to trash, and it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what eco-socionomic category you fall in. And I thought to myself, wow, that's not a word.
Yeah, I was reading that script, and I said, did the same thing. It's socioeconomic, and I'm reading it going, okay, whatever. Good catch, Mo.
Yeah, thanks. But, you know, then just sort of repeating what or playing what Michelle Obama said and then just screaming with indignation what over and over again, it doesn't speak to an argument. If she had a point to be made about the Obama's position on education, on early education or public schools, then I would have liked to have heard it. But just screaming that you don't care for someone's opinion, particularly the First Lady, and then referring to them as trash is just the weakest argument. It's the lamest effort at demagoguery. It just shows you've got no bullets in your chamber. You've got nothing to scream about.
But Mo, isn't that sort of emblematic? The reason I brought this example up was that it was emblematic of what's going on in the big picture, because that's it. I mean, that's what they've got. The president just basically said to this newspaper, he said, that they're just against whatever we're for at this point. You know, what's your big idea? And if death is, you know, even from the congressman, there's been no alternative budget, no alternative plan, no alternative other than let the whole system collapse. And their commentators are saying, calling the first lady trash.
Yeah, the commentators are really just reflecting what really is the agenda and the real talking points that they're coming up with. You know, their real alternative is to cooperate with the president. But that's politics. They would have to stop politicking. They would have to stop playing the dirty ball that, quite frankly, all politicians have to play in some form or another and really participate in the process. There's an insanely popular new president in the White House. He's smart. He's engaged. He's enthusiastic. And he has the support of the voters. They don't know what to do. They are grasping at straws. And it really, I would be so impressed if anybody from the other side said, you know what? The guy won the election. Let's try it his way. Not a struck, but really get on board.
What? Are you crazy?
Well, yeah, I might be, but it would be impressive, don't
yeah.
you think?
Absolutely.
They got on board with the effort of looking at, listen, and if he fails, I'll be the first one to say, hey, I tried. But that takes too much foresight. Takes too much strength to do that, and there's none of either of those things on that side, as far as I can tell.
Well, Mo, it would also indicate that they had some brains, because it would be the smartest thing you could possibly do in this environment than to be the party of no. Thanks for calling, Mo. Appreciate your quick call. Hey, listen to this. How weirdly analogous this was to the Depression. So I'm reading my FDR, The New Deal Years by Ken Davis book again. And he was talking about, okay, FDR, wildly popular, because there was this huge sense of, you know, the banks were, there was a run on banks, massive unemployment, all the same things kind of happening. And Hoover was the party of no, we can't intervene. FDR ran on the government, the most widely applauded line in his inaugural speech was not, fear not. Fear is the only thing we have to fear. Not that line. A lot of people think it was. It was the line about that he will use all powers under the Constitution as if this were a war, as if we were under attack, was the most wildly popular line, and the people loved him. So Walter Lippmann, who was a very, the columnist, probably the Paul Krugman or greater of the day, had met with President-elect Roosevelt, and said that his big concern, he had been writing, is saying that Congress must not be allowed to obstruct, to delay, to mutilate, and to confuse. He was worried that he wanted FDR to suspend debate and execute his proposals for a full year, because he said that the biggest danger, the great danger, was not that Congress would give FDR too much power, that it'll deny him the power he needs in a crisis. And we're in a crisis. And what are we seeing? The commentators saying the First Lady's trash. The congressmen insisting that their voices shout down the Fed Reserve chairman, even though they don't understand the complexity of the crisis. And you're telling me this is not similar to the Depression? I'll beg to differ on that one. Take your calls on that, 866-991-9927. More to come on the Geithner plan. And the president's day, press conference tonight on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Take me. more trouble yet. Today, you're not getting rid of me that easy. 1-866-991-9927, the number to the Nancy Skinner program. As we anticipate the second news conference delivered by President Obama today, on the heels of those riveting hearings at the House Financial Services Committee. Riveting to me, maybe, perhaps, and nobody else. But I dig this stuff. I really follow it carefully. We have critics on the right, as we just talked about, people that just say completely useless things like the First Lady is just trash, okay? Members of Congress who have no good ideas of their own on the Republican side. As far as I've heard, I have not seen any put forward. We also have critics on the left who don't agree with the president's plan, and especially as it relates to when we start talking about the banking solutions. I think there's more consensus when it's the fiscal stimulus bill across economic theories. But when it comes to dealing with the toxic assets that are on the books of the banks and how to get them off the books and recover from the banking crisis part of this, yeah, there's a little bit of controversy as it regards that, I would say, even among those who would consider themselves of a progressive bent. Nomi Prince is joining me. Nomi has written a piece for Mother Jones on criticizing this panning Geithner's plan as well. She's a former investment banker and has co-authored a couple of books on the subject, Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket. And she's picked apart Tim Geithner's plan, so I thought, all right, let's just rationally discuss this with an investment banker. I'm not an investment banker, Nomi, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. Does that count?
That works. I think that works. Actually, that probably means you could be trading credit derivatives at AIG. So,
well, that's kind of scary. Well, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Better than they're doing, I should point out.
Well, I'm a finance major from the University of Michigan, so that maybe counts for a little bit. But this is a whole new world. Just watching, I was out there talking about credit default swaps, watching them turn into this monstrous market and talking about them on television saying, hey, like, we don't know, this is like $64 trillion at the time when I was on about a year ago. Now it's $164 trillion. There was no regulation of this exotic instrument. And so you were working where as an investment banker? Let's get the bio before I'm able to look into your plan here.
Well, I actually worked over in London for Bear Stearns when it used to exist. Way back. And I actually got involved in the credit derivatives market in the beginning of it in early 2000. And then, before that in the CDO market, which is this other acronym meaning a bunch of toxic stuff you throw into something, make it look good and sell off to anyone who will buy it, for a better price and take a fee off the top of that. So I was involved in that.
Explain for people then, if you will, in the early years, what a credit default swap is.
Well, I look at it like this. I've been trying to talk in terms that I actually am not fantastic at, but car terms. And I think credit default swaps have been given this aura of really complicated things, which has helped the people who have wanted to create them and profit from them and talk about their bailouts and everything else. But they're actually not as complicated as they're being talked about. It's sort of like it's car insurance, but instead of for cars, it's for
corporate bonds.
The corporate bonds defaulting, or bunches of corporate bonds defaulting, or bunches of subprime loans defaulting, or basically anything that can stop paying you, where you have the likelihood that they'll default and you won't get payments you expected. In a car, you pay premium for your insurance, right? You pay $100 or $150, whatever it is per month. Your insurance company collects that, and if you have an accident, you hope, they will pay out on that and get your car back to whatever state it was in before the accident. The insurance company writes you that policy and says, okay, well, I have a lot of people paying premiums. I don't expect them all to have accidents. So the ones that pay me premiums will more than cover me for anyone who will have an accident. And I have history of information on this and I can compute this. So a credit default swap is kind of like that. One side pays in a premium like you do in any insurance contract for the benefit of being helped when the situation gets worse, if a car crashes or if a corporate bond or a bunch of subprime loans default. And what AIG did, and $58 trillion worth of the stuff was created on the back of this idea that nothing would default or very little would default. And so the insurance companies or the people insuring this stuff, like AIG and others, assume they would never have to pay out. Your car would never crash. These things would not default. Or at least if they did, it was containable. And obviously that wasn't the fact. And so all of a sudden they're like, well, gee, we only took in the whole world, $2 trillion worth of premiums for $58 trillion worth of stuff. So obviously if all this stuff needs to get paid out, you only have $2 trillion to pay it out with, you come to the government because there's no way you can make that up. And that's kind of the situation that we have now.
Well then, so, okay, let's stick with your insurance analogy there. Because the difference between regular car insurance and this type of situation, your analogy, is that everybody has to have insurance when you're driving a car. That's the law. You all have to have it. So that insurance company knows there is certainty that there's going to be a certain income stream and a certain accident stream, and there's a payout. The problem with this, Nomi, as I see it, is that you have banks that have to pay. There's FDIC insurance. We've learned that lesson through the Depression, and all the banks pay a small, tiny little premium, and you have this insured pool of bank assets, but they repealed Glass-Steagall, and now you have a whole universe of non-banks, like insurance companies investment banks and all these other companies merging. So you the analogy is you don't have everyone paying into that same pool. You don't have that insurance. So when it does, there is a run on it, a bank run or a run on a market, what we're seeing now, a new animal, a deflationary downward spiral. You don't have the money to cover it. And so Geithner, I read your piece in Mother Jones, kind of attacking the plan in terms of what was presented, but and I want to get into that. But now, today, there's a new development in that they're saying, look, folks, we need that additional insurance. We need a resolution authority so that when non-banks come to us, we are able to have sticks and not just carrots, not just write a checkbook. Don't you think that after what you heard today, I know you're watching the hearings, that some of your concerns have been resolved based on what you wrote in Mother Jones?
Not fully. The thing is this. It makes sense, certainly, to, you know, like you're saying, we've got to regulate this market. We've got to not have insurance companies acting like hedge funds and having one set of rules, and hedge funds having another set of rules, and everybody playing with the same assets, but everybody doing it with different rules. And it does make sense to do something where everyone's in the same tent and you can watch them. But the thing is, you can't just watch them. You actually have to have them all play by the same rules. And you also have to have them not be complicated enough so that when they play by those rules, you actually can see what they're doing. And they're playing fair and open with those rules. We had a situation in the last few years where banks, just regular old banks like Citigroup and Bank of America, Citigroup in particular, took $1 trillion worth of assets off their books. It was outside of the Fed's regulatory eyes, and it was just being used to borrow more money against. And so when they turn around and say, okay, well, we don't have that money to pay back and come to the government, that's a cost, even though there was a regulatory body watching it. So we need to do both of those things. We definitely need to have all these guys being watched, and not some of them sort of doing things around sidelines.
Okay, so when we come back, Nomi Prinz is my guest. She's written a piece panning Geithner's plan for Mother Jones. We'll talk about, we'll simplify it a little because I don't want, people's heads are spinning. I am telling you, I hear this, I get the emails. They don't, you're talking, an investment banker talking to a finance major. Oh, that's really helpful. 866-991-9927. What are your questions about this? What is striking you? I know this is crazy, seemingly complicated stuff, but we'll keep with the auto analogy. And we'll look at the plan. We'll make it as simple, since I'm in Detroit. We'll make it as simple as possible, and then talk about, you know, some constructive criticism. At least that's happening on our side of the aisle. We're talking about it. 866-991-9927, the number to the Nancy Skinner Program. right back in here because we got lots going on today. Trying to deconstruct the meltdown. Oh, on the Nancy Skinner program. Welcome. 866-991-9927, the number to the program. My guest is Nomi Prinz. She is a former Goldman managing director and author of Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America. Working on a new book called It Takes a Pillage. So, before we get, I thought through the break, I was thinking through, since I am in Detroit, Nomi, I have an analogy for we're going to go with the autos, but I have a quick, Lisa's calling. She has a quick question, so let's get Lisa into the show. Hi, Lisa, you had a question for Nomi?
Hi, yes. Basically, I've heard this before, and it seems like a simple question, but if the federal government has billions of dollars to give to one company, why can't it give $1 million to each person in the United States to take care of his or her own debt?
I hear that a lot, too, in different ways, Lisa. It's a really good question, and I'll tell you something else beyond just what it can give one company. Without getting into, I don't even know how many zeros, well, it's a lot of zeros, but the government has spent between, depending on how you look at it, $10 to $12 trillion actually at this point, with a trillion, like 12 and many zeros, basically bailing, setting up loans for these banks to borrow against the toxic assets they had, et cetera, helping the FDIC ensure our deposits, you know, like Nancy was talking about before. And if it actually paid off, every single home mortgage in the entire country, everyone.
Right.
Not just some, every single person, it would cost $10 trillion. If it literally said, all right, instead of 10 or 12 going to the banks, every single person gets their mortgage paid off, the home industry would you know, basically be solid. The loans against
Nomi, you're talking about, are you talking about the FDR home loan program?
I'm just making the point that we basically paid as a government. Not even the FDR. I'm actually talking about that amount of money, which is, it's far above that kind of program. The amount of money that the government has put behind various parts of this bailout,
Say, all right, there are different components to this. So I don't want to confuse people. There was the stimulus part of it, okay, stimulus bill, $1 trillion. And are you a Keynesian, economic person? You realize we have to jumpstart the economy when you have a deflationary spiral, right? That's different than the banking. So when you're saying enough money, when Lisa's asking that question, this bank bailout money, I mean, some of those are loans out there,
yes.
And some of those are guarantees. Those aren't giving money. And there's a lot of confusion out there. People feel like we're just giving these trillions of dollars away. And that's
they're
not
giving
either.
Money if they get paid back. The thing is, the collateral behind them, because that's the collateral the banks wanted to get rid of. A lot of what is lent outside of the bailout is actually lent against some of those same toxic assets that they're trying to get rid of. It's like if you have a bad car and you're trying to say, you know what, I want to get a loan from a friend to buy something else. How about, I'll give you my car. Just, you know, spot me the $1,000. I'm telling you, the car drives, it's great. Just, you know, give me $1,000, I'm out of here. I loaned you $1,000 for that car. Car doesn't drive. But
so you're assuming, though, that the assets are bad assets necessarily. But most of those assets we're talking about are home mortgages or housing values that have fallen because they're sucked into this vortex. So the values are, you know, there's foreclosures and there's this downward spiral. But like in the Depression, that's why I went back to that, what they did is the government just went in and bought up 2 million mortgages. And they said, because they stopped that spiral from continuing to go down, and they ended up, the housing values ended up rebounding, and they made a profit on that. So it is possible to do that. So your analogy of the car just trying to get rid of a bad car is not the you know, those housing values, there is some value in there. I mean,
no, I want to buy the loans. I want the houses. I don't want the assets that were constructed out of those houses. I'm saying if we go and help all the home loans, which is what the FDR program did, that will, like you said, that'll definitely stabilize a lot of things. We haven't really done that. We've been basically going to the top of banks and saying, here's some money, or lending money in return, not for the homes, not for the loans, but for the assets
Right, but if we just did that, if we just went directly Enron and tried to bail out homeowners, the problem is you still would have this problem where banks, the credit is not flowing again, and credit is the lifeblood of our economy. So if the banks don't feel like they have enough capital requirements to start loaning to small businesses, then it doesn't matter that you help the homes because small businesses aren't getting their things. The auto, people can't buy cars in Detroit. What I would rather see, I think this is a very good plan to start with, but what the one missing link to me that's not in here is that it should be dependent upon people buying things, not just get credit moving for the sake of getting credit moving, but that there's incentives for people to go out and start buying again and building aggregate demand so they can buy again.
Well, absolutely. And
I got to let you answer that question because I just set you up and I can't let you answer in 10 seconds, Nomi. Are you able to stay with us?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry about doing that. That was my bad, and I want to be fully give you every chance to respond to that. So I do very much appreciate you staying with us, and Nomi Prince will answer that because I don't sabotage people here on the Nancy Skinner program, unlike some radio hosts out there. I'm fair. 866-991-9927. Panny Geithner's plan is Nomi Prince. Sorry, I should get that right. And we'll keep going at it. Take your calls as well on the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm sorry for the person I became. I'm sorry that it took so long for me to change. I'm ready to feels like you made a mistake. You made somebody's heart break. Now I have to let you go. I have to let you go. Do you find yourself wandering around trying to find car analogies for everything in your life? Then I'm catchy. Then you're catching on to the Nancy Skinner program because I do often use auto and car-like analogies to explain things as intense as global economic meltdowns. You name it. Really, I don't discriminate. 866-991-9927. Nomi Prince is nice enough to stay with us. She's written a very thoughtful piece in Mother Jones. She is the author of a couple of books, and she has one in the works called It Takes a Pillage. Nomi, I can't wait. We'll have you back when's that coming out?
It should be out in the fall. Of course, there's so much information constantly, but it'll be up to the minute by the fall when it comes out.
So. Okay, so you're a former investment banker, and that's what we were discussing. So I before the break, I wanted to make sure I let you address what I, for people who are just joining us, let's put it into context here in your piece. What you're saying is you think that the government should not be in your piece, Geithner told the Wall Street Journal last week, our judgment is that the best way to get through this is if we can work with the markets. We don't want the government to assume all the risk. We want the private sector to work with us. You say the same private sector, these are the same guys that helped us create and spread a toxic stew of derivatives. Why would we want them involved, right? That we should just bypass the private sector and have the government do either, what are you saying, do nothing? Or are you saying just give the money directly to homeowners and businesses and not have a banking system, like bypass the flow of credit through banks?
Well, right now, yeah, certainly we know the banks have tightened up their credit because they have a lot of assets on their books and they're using any money they have to basically support these assets. So obviously the assets not being on the books is going to help. But part of the problem with the particulars of the plan is that the private sector, and the ones that would buy these assets, they're like hedge funds and private equity investors. That's who they are. These guys get taxed less than we do. These guys bought a lot of the stuff to begin with and dumped it onto the banks so that the banks are stuck with it. And they don't have a responsibility to individuals that banks should have. You know, if you go to Bank of America or JP Morgan and Chase or Citi, you know, we give them our money. It's insured by the FDIC, and the government has every obligation for us as citizens to make sure that continues, and that's part of a bank.
Mm-hmm.
When they start doing funky things with our loans, that's when the bank oversteps its boundaries, and simply, I think, finding a bunch of people who are even way beyond those boundaries to begin with and saying, look, we're going to loan you money. Yes, you'll put up some, but we'll put up more.
to buy these assets that you didn't want to begin with, I think that's dangerous. It is our governmental risk. It is our taxpayer risk to do that. We're basically saying to these hedge funds, look, we'll give you $6 if you put up a dollar to buy $7 worth of toxic assets. The government has the risk in that, unless all the assets do well. So far, a lot of them haven't. And so that's part of the problem, not to do nothing with them, but not necessarily to allow really a lot of the group that's been a part of creating the problem.
So then how do you move it to the point where you say, look, okay, the do-nothing option is not an option. The we do it all ourselves, the government just buy up all this stuff, that's not an option either. That's like eliminating the car dealership in your analogy. And you can't just have GM selling cars to the to individual people showing up at a the corporate headquarters in Dearborn, okay? So there is a role for them. Is it that you don't like the risk-reward ratio if we get the... See, my view is this. Look it. They came out today and they said, we need the resolution authority. We need the sticks and not just the carrots. I agree with you, Nomi, that we got to fix the disparate treatment of income, capital gains versus wage income, that there's got to be... And they talked about this today. Bernanke and Geithner said, we need a whole new, more comprehensive regulatory system so that we're not just looking at each institution, but we have an overview of where bubbles are starting and that they are going to have to be scrutinized. If we are able to get through that and then install these new rules of engagement, if you will, so that this doesn't happen again, isn't that the best way instead of either zero or 1,000? Isn't it better to be able to use the power of the market, set them straight, and fix them like we did after the Depression than
either
extreme?
After the Depression. Absolutely. And after the Depression, what FDR did, which was super smart, was he put together the Glass-Steagall Act with Congress, and they said, you know what? We're going to take the risky banks, put them aside, let them do what they do, speculate, do whatever, and we're going to put the commercial banks, the cities, the Banks of America, the parts of them that deal with people and small loans and car loans and mortgages, we're going to back them. We're going to create an FDIC to back their deposits. We're going to watch them. We're going to help them. And all the speculative people that actually created the Great Depression and the crash of 1929 mm-hmm. that preceded it, they're on their own. We support the banks in the functions that relate to driving this economy, to flowing that credit, to helping individuals, and to making sure that their money is safe and that their loans are available. And that's where we spend our money. That's where we spend our regulations. That's where we spend our focus.
Okay.
And to the extent we get back to that, that'll create a safer environment in terms of everything that Obama and Geithner are proposing. That, yes, that will create a much more stable environment for everybody.
I think you and I are closer than we think we are, Nomi Prince. I appreciate you spending this time because it's really complicated stuff. And so when you come back, I know your book's not coming out till the fall, so we'll have you back as we unravel and try to deconstruct the global meltdown.
I would like that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me. That's Nomi Prince. Her piece is in Mother Jones Magazine. You can check that out online at Mother Jones Magazine. Okay, so let's see. Oh, you know what? Joseph, I'm sorry, Joseph, did you have a question for Nomi or was it for me?
Hello?
Hi, Joe. Hi, it's Nancy. Did you have a question for Nomi or were you?
Well, it was for Nomi, but I guess you can, either one of you. With the analogy she made with the car insurance and the credit default swaps.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the difference is that I can buy insurance on my car, but with credit default swaps, I can also buy insurance on your car as well.
That's right. You are insuring a debt.
Right. And anyone with the money and the sense to know that the bubble is going to burst could play that game.
Right, and that's what they did.
And there's absolutely no regulation on it.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. That's what they're saying. That's what these guys, that's what Geithner and Obama and everyone's saying, is that this has been allowed because we had this massive deregulation, all these exotic instruments. They didn't have enough collateral, enough hedge when they were selling these, that exactly that Ponzi scheme that you described, and they knew it. And so that's the business they're trying to unwind right now.
You mentioned the word Ponzi. But our whole financial system is a legal Ponzi scheme.
Right. And what they're proposing now is to fix it, so that it's not devastating, so that everyone doesn't get wiped out, and then put bigger, new, bolder rules in place so that it can't happen again, Joseph.
And then people keep, you know, using capitalism like it's a dirty word, but anything that you put ism on is going to sound like a dirty word, but really what we should have is a free market economy.
Well,
everyone cheats.
Well, the free market, right? That's what Ron Paul was saying today that got me so upset. What do you support, the market or crony capitalism?
Right.
Listen, the market is what it is. Mm-hmm. The market will drive people to excess. And so I believe in capitalism, but what we have learned time and time again, sometimes more painfully than others, is that the market has to be regulated. Then it's like a football game. You know, here's a good thing. No, here's a bit. It's either cars or football with me.
You have to have some rules.
Right. Absolutely. But if you didn't have rules in football, if you didn't have, you know, holding or whatever, if you had no rules, then football would be crazy too. Everybody knows you got four downs, you got 10 yards. I mean, there are rules. And so what we're talking about with the global economy is that the rules, as it got more complex, just have to be a lot more. They have to be bigger and bolder and stronger. Otherwise, everybody's driving on the wrong side of the road. Right.
Well, someone has to. Can't go to sleep at the switch, because the guys that are involved in making these decisions are, it's hard to keep up with them, much less stay a step ahead.
That's why you've got me, Joseph, because I'm keeping up with them, and I appreciate you calling. I have another guest on the line we want to get in here, but thanks a lot. But that's really, honestly, that is why you have me, sir. I follow all this, and I take critics it's not just unflinching. I think through all this stuff. Critics, you know, I look at those on the right. I've looked at the Geithner plan. I also have one element that I think is missing that I have said before, which is this element of not just getting credit to flow for the sake of getting credit to flow, which I think is a good plan, absolutely, the Geithner plan. It is that the end game, maybe it should be tied, that the credit has to be tied to real purchases of goods and services so that you get the whole soul, you get the whole, not the vicious circle, but the virtuous circle. I think I need to blog on this. In the meantime, John Sekowitz has been holding on. We ran a little long in that last segment, so we're going to let him jump in here and then take him in the last segment. John, we might even have to bring you back, given all this is going on. He's a general partner at Templar Advisors, so he has been, I guess they manage offshore accounts, the host of The Truth About Money, NPR show out in California, and he's an editor for the North Bay Bohemian and has been so kind as to hang on. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you. We have a short time and then a break, and then we'll get you back in here. But basically, you also you don't like the Geithner plan, right?
Oh, not at all. It's going to add trillions more to our national debt, which now stands at a very onerous $13 trillion. Then there's a very good option that this will – a very good possibility that this will not work. And if it doesn't work, it will certainly be what catapults us from this great recession into the next great depression.
So what's your big idea?
What's my big idea? I had on my show a guy by the name of Tom Patrick, who was the former vice chairman and longtime CFO, the chief financial officer at Merrill Lynch. He saved, as CFO, he saved the firm twice. And in 2003, 2004, when he then warned chairman and CEO of Merrill Lynch, Stanley O'Neill, that the massive underwriting of subprimes would blow up the firm, he was forced out of Merrill.
Okay, so you're giving me the biography of a person when I asked you what your big idea was. What's your big idea?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I want to establish the credibility of the guy who has the idea. Tom Patrick has got this plan that would not cost taxpayers money. It's a plan where he would decouple the good securitizations from the bad. There is something like, just in residential mortgages, and we're talking about the subprimes and the alt-A's, there's something like 3,400 securitizations out there. It's quite a universe. His plan would separate the good from the bad, repackage the good, and reissue them as good securities. But this whole business of having the Feds co-partner with the robber barons like the BlackRock and the Blackstone Group and the Carlyle Group and what have you, in a plan that's no risk to them, that's 100% risk to the American taxpayer, that's highly leveraged in a situation where the credit crisis was caused by too much leverage, and that assumes that banks are solvent when they're really not, is ill-conceived.
Okay. All right, I'm going to let you, we're up against the break, so hold on. We'll let you finish your thought on that, John, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you, you said the big plan was to figure out the good securities from the bad and separate them, and that's, how do you do that? You're saying that the government can do it better, that the government can do it better than these guys, the Blackstones and whatnot. There are a lot of other players involved in institutional markets than just the bad guys. As easy as that is, the bad guys versus good guys, you know, because I'm in Detroit. That's what we're trying to do, is figure out the bad assets from the good assets and incentivize that process from happening. So I'll shut up. We'll take a break. We'll come back. John will get to answer that question. 866-991-9927. Boy, you're getting an education in international finance today on the Nancy Skinner Program. The good old days in talk radio, we could just talk about the merits of impeachment. Now we have to deconstruct the entire global financial system in 3 hours every day. It'll all go back to normal someday. I assure you of that. I assure you, like the president will tonight, that everything's going to be okay eventually. On the Nancy Skinner Program, 866-991-9927. I'm having a discussion with John Sackowitz, who hates the Geithner plan, agrees with Paul Krugman. He has a big idea of figuring it out himself by saying we need to take the good assets and separate them from the bad assets. I guess, John, the place where we are disagreeing is that you think the government should be solely responsible for that. And I see the merit of involving the market. And I know there are bad guys in the market, but there are also other institutional players. I see the value of them being involved, sharing some of the risk and with the taxpayers on the upside.
Well, I disagree. I think that the big five that Larry Summers announced yesterday that were lining up to participate in this public-private investment plan. These are the robber barons that really caused the problem. You know, the Blackstone Group never did a deal with their own money that they couldn't do with somebody else's money. They are leveraged up to the eyeballs. BlackRock, Kinko, the Wellington Capital. These are the names, these are hardly household names, but these are really the big power players behind the scenes on Wall Street. They're the ones that borrow just hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, if not more, to finance collateralized mortgage obligations and debt obligations.
I don't think that I don't think that there's anything sacred about these five firms. I think I heard the testimony today, and they're just talking about having not. So you and I individuals aren't able to auction. You go through your whoever you use to invest your funds. If you have a pension fund, if you have an investment fund manager, they're not saying only these five institutions are allowed in this auction.
No, well, actually, they set the bar very high. To be able to participate in this plan, I think you have to be liquid to the tune of $500 million and have to have demonstrated that you've managed at least $2 billion. That's a pretty high bar.
Because we're going to give them, we are going to partner with them to take off the books these assets that have stopped the flow of credit. I want to make sure that the partners in these auctions, that these aren't fly-by-night operations, and that some guy in Nigeria that can write an email saying, "Dear sir, help me transfer $3.5 million in U.S. funds," is not the guy getting the bid.
Well, we're not talking about that. That's not the only other option, Nancy. The other option is to nationalize our banks. Our banks are insolvent. That's the dark and dirty secret. We have monetized. This is a plan to monetize insolvent banks. There's no question about it. Banks like Citigroup and financial institutions like AIG are unequivocally insolvent. All right.
All right. Well, we agree on this, John. And that was today. This came out. It said it in the hearing that they want a new resolution authority that will essentially do that. Will essentially be able to, because right now the FDIC can do it with banks. This is about moving to the next step. And if we're going to be involved, if we're going to have skin in this game, then we need to be able to do the same thing with non-bank institutions. And the Bernanke, Geithner, Obama apparently is sending legislation to Congress next week to do it. Then you and I can, you know, go hang out and agree, right, that all is well in the universe.
I'm a lifelong Democrat. I want to see Obama succeed. This is not the way to do it. What Bernanke did last week with this massive quantitative easing, $1 trillion plan, and what Geithner did this week with another $1 trillion plan is really to run the risk of igniting hyperinflation.
Okay. Right. On that note, John, I'm out of time. Will you come back and join me, because we've got some talking to do?
Absolutely. And what your listeners should know is that there are a lot of.
I'm like 10 seconds. I gotta go. I really got it. You're in radio. You know what that's about. But we'll have you back. John Sackowitz will join us. This conversation ain't going nowhere. We'll all watch the president's news conference tonight. We'll discuss it tomorrow. Hopefully your head is not spinning. And the dumb analogies are working. If not, we'll try again tomorrow right here on the Nancy Skinner Show.